The Guardian.
The Guardian Books podcast from the Edinburgh International Book Festival.
The overarching theme of this year's festival is revolution in the 21st century. And I wanted to explore that because it seems to me that there have been so many different kinds of changes going on in the world over the last 20 or 25 years, beginning with perhaps with the invention of the digital realm. And we have Heather Brook, whose book, The Revolution, will be digitised. She'll be in conversation with The Guardian deputy editor Ian Katz. And then, of course, there are the political events which could be described as revolutionary this year. The Arab Spring uprisings in North Africa and the Middle East. And Achdaf Souef will be joining us from Egypt. And Hisham Mattar, Libyan writer. And then, of course, there's the ways in which digital revolutions, if they are revolutions, and the political revolutions are interacting in some way. We've heard lots of talk about Twitter revolutions, and I wanted to ask really whether or not there is such thing. Is it possible for 140 characters to precipitate a revolution? I rather doubt it, but that's why it's a theme of a festival and not simply an easy answer.
We're at the book festival, Charlotte Square.
We're in the Pepper Theatre and we're about to see
a show about the use of internet and media in the Middle East, particularly about Iran.
I'm hoping to learn a little bit more how maybe television media has been pushed out in the place of social media networks like Facebook, etc.
Well, I'm sure I'll learn something new, I hope so. I suppose I am wanting to look at a kind of holistic view of things, not just about Iran, although I'm particularly interested in Iran, to see if we can kind of learn from other experiences. Of course, Iran had their big kind of revolution in 2009, and I feel that other countries have a lot to learn from what was good and what kind of didn't work there, for particular reasons. So I'm sure we'll learn something.
I'm Golam Kiavani.
I'm Annabel Srebrenny, and our book is called Bloggistan.
Well, we start the book with one of the things we try and puncture is that sense of, oh, wow, oh, my goodness, people in the Middle East are technologically savvy. Come on. You know, Iran, it's an old civilization, an old culture. It's got rich intellectual traditions. It's got many universities. The universities are increasingly feminized. Over 60% of students at universities are women. Since the previous president, Khatami, in the late 90s, it's been a solidly modernizing developmental state, putting a lot of money into developing e-infrastructure, and often trying to compare Iran with Canada and Singapore and having pretensions to be, you know, up there with, you know, highly technologized societies. That's kind of slipped back recently, but it's estimated, I think, something like 30 million of 70 million Iranians now have ready access to the internet. There are still internet cafes, although they are surveyed at times and, you know, are licensed. So there are a lot of people with access. And as many young people in many parts of the world, but particularly in a society where leisure time, as we know it, going out to a bar, going to a club, going out to dance, is all not available. I mean, there is theatre, there's cinema, but it's not the leisure time activity that we know. The regime itself is keeping young people at home on the net, learning the tricks of the trade. So many Iranians have been the most brilliant hackers and avoiders of technological surveillance by the regime, you know, instantly.
In your talk, you actually used the metaphor of halal internet. I thought that was fascinating.
This is a new policy. They have been actually debating this in the past few months. Initially, it was supposed to be pure internet. Then, inspired by the Chinese example of national internet project, they tried to kind of, in a way, do that and even actually had some kind of, I would say, expansionist dream about having this Islamic digital kind of, in a way, empire in which they would actually export the idea to Saudi Arabia, to Sudan, to Morocco, to Tunisia, and so on and so forth, creating a pure spaces for that. After that, they decided to go for a better known term, which is called halal internet. Effectively, it means trying to identify in the first place the websites and spaces in cyberspace that are not appropriate or not good. But then there is a dispute about, first of all, you need a lot of resources to just go and comb through pages and pages and pages and pages and pages and God knows how many websites. So that's one resource that the Iranian state doesn't have, certainly can't afford that. Secondly, there will be a dispute about which one is inappropriate and which one it is. I mean, especially in the case of Iran, we have had newspapers closed down which were actually controlled and owned by, let's say, the brother of the supreme leader or an ex-minister of intelligence and so on and so forth. So there is no consensus exactly what is it that is illegal or inappropriate. After that, there is the issues of implementing the policy. Who's supposed to be in charge of that? Ministry of Intelligence, Iranian broadcasters, Ministry of Culture, Judiciary, Office of President, the Supreme Leader. So there is a really, really fantastic and fascinating competing interest between different kind of anyway groups, because they might actually close down that website because it's close to Ahmadinejad, and at the moment there is a dispute between Ahmadinejad and some conservatives within the Iranian state. So it becomes a kind of anyway game and a play which ends in more dispute, more tension, and as a result more possibility for some movements from below.
Now, Annabelle, we've talking a lot about revolution. This podcast is about revolution. But you one thing you've said, which I thought was very interesting, was actually history, the jury is out as to whether this is a revolution.
Well, I was making that point in relationship to Arab Spring and the idea that the media particularly, I mean, the argument was made that the internet invites very quick hype and very quick closure about contemporary events. So, for example, Al Jazeera very quickly named the event Arab Spring, and various commentators have said, well, that doesn't really do justice to what's happening. You know, that's a very unpolitical metaphor. But then Al Jazeera also very quickly was talking about Arab Revolution as though it had already happened. And commentators are saying, well, to change, you know, the man at the top to get rid of Ben Ali or Mubarak is an important political shift. But is that adequate to name something as revolution? I mean, is there a real change in... is there a real shift to democratization of the system? Are there new parties? Are there new forms of representation? Are different elements of the society actually given a voice? So it was in relationship to this very quick attempt to frame events that the internet and blogging and websites allow us to do. But then we get language that fixes things very quickly. And perhaps, you know, history... we always make sense of history by looking back, and actually if we're writing history in the present and allowing media to write history in the present, we're missing a lot of the complexity and richness and nuance of what's actually going on.
So how important is blogging to this revolution, or indeed very fast evolution perhaps?
I suppose one of the main points that we try and make in the book is politics is made by people using a range of tools. So to name Iran, the blogging revolution, or the Facebook revolution, or Tunisia as the Twitter revolution, are fairly fatuous and limiting notions of how political change happens. People have always made political change. The French Revolution happened without Twitter and Facebook. Oh my goodness, you know, let's remember this. So we're, but at the same time, it's evident that particularly in contexts like Iran, which has made face-to-face politics, even small, repeated small gatherings, let alone demonstrations on the street, so difficult to organize. And in parts of the Arab world, where again, face-to-face politics were often quite constrained, it's clear that the new communication technologies are fantastic tools. They're tools for organizing, they're tools for mobilizing, they're tools for sharing information. But these are forms of political communication, and we absolutely mustn't get hung up on the technologies themselves. People will use whatever is available to them. And so, you know, it's not Twitter that makes a revolution, it's the people in the society making political change.
Don't read blogs. I read some of the American blogs, Liberal One, Huffington Post, Daily Kos, ones like those.
A lot of librarian ones for work, because I'm a librarian, and librarians are very into blogging because they like to show that they're, you know, at the cutting edge.
And there's a really great blog by an Edinburgh-based publisher called Nicola Morgan, who's called, it's called Right to be Published, and there she writes about all of the problems that face authors, the challenges, how you might want to overcome them, answers questions and queries, and she's got a fantastic blog roll of really great literary blogs that's good to go and have a look through, so I always enjoy her blog.
And a lot of sewing ones, because I'm learning to sew.
I actually don't read any blogs.
No, Twitter, ugh.
I haven't the faintest idea what blogs are.
I am a technophobe. I didn't actually have my own blog, but my boyfriend kept it updated. Like, it was the two of us. It was supposedly both of us doing it, but it was my boyfriend that wrote it all. So, I'm a social media phobe.
And then there's Jen Campbell, who's known as online in the online world as Airplane Girl, has a blog called Weird Things Customers Say in Bookshops, which has had huge social media success and is coming out as a book. But you can go and read Jen's blog, and it's very entertaining to see their approach to the secondhand bookselling and rare books world.
My name is Corey Doctorow, and I write science fiction novels.
Corey, for listeners who only know you through your novels, you've also been involved in direct activism yourself, haven't you?
Yeah, I worked for a long time for an NGO called the Electronic Frontier Foundation. That's sort of like liberty for the internet. I was the European director at the end, and before that I worked in San Francisco at their headquarters.
Okay, well, let's start by talking about the riots in the UK this month. I wondered what your reaction was to David Cameron expressing his desire that we should curb the use of social media to tackle violence on the streets.
Well, I think the great irony is that last week, Cameron's government investigated a proposal to block the web to protect copyrights, a proposal that had been mooted in the Digital Economy Act and that had been addressed in detail in the Hargreaves Report. And the Hargreaves Report concluded that this proposal would be ineffective, that it's not just disproportionate, which is something that I believe, that creating censorship regimes to protect copyright is not a proportionate thing you want in a democracy, but that it wouldn't work, that it technically wouldn't work, that people who wanted to do bad things would find it trivial to get around the web blocks that we put in. I always think of China. You know, you have this country that has more engineers than any other nation on earth. They manufacture the networking kit that we all use. The Politburo is composed entirely of engineers. If anyone can solve a technical problem, they can. And not only that, they have the capacity, if you break the law, to put you in jail and harvest your organs for party members. And they've never managed to make an effective censor wall. So the idea that David Cameron can, I find incredibly dubious. And given that last week he found that web blocking was not an evidence-led regulatory scheme, it makes me wonder why it is he thinks all of a sudden it's now possible. It seems to me that Cameron has fallen prey to the trap of the security syllogism, which goes like this: something must be done. There, I've done something.
And also, of course, just about 6 months ago, he himself was praising online social platforms as a powerful tool in the hands of citizens. So it's a bit of a vault fast, isn't it?
I don't think that it's actually contradictory to say that it is both a powerful tool in the hands of citizens and a powerful tool in the hands of vandals or crooks or what have you. You know, the motorways are incredibly powerful tools for people who want to get away from bank robberies. We can't design anti-bank robber motorways. We don't know how to design a general purpose communications network that is that runs all the expressions of speech that we love and doesn't allow those expressions of speech that cause social harm.
But if we accept that there is a place for these networks to do the things that we want them to do, then we have to accept that they're also going to be misused as well.
Oh yeah, well, so if you accept the Hargreaves Report as the Cameron government has, then what you have to come to the conclusion you must draw is, if we block social networks during times of social unrest, people who want to use them for legitimate purposes, like saying, I'm okay, I'm not burned alive, honey, and our shop has been burgled, we need to get in touch with the insurance agency, and what the hell is going on, and I have some perspective on this that isn't expressed in the news media, and all those other things that people say to each other during times of crisis, those people will be effectively cut off. People who want to say, there's a building on fire, would you like to come and help me rob it, will not have much trouble getting around it. This is the conclusion the Cameron government reached on its own.
Mm. You see science fiction, don't you, as activist literature, and I wondered if you could think of any examples of where science fiction really has changed the world.
You know, there's so much of it. In fact, our whole vocabulary for talking about social problems that arise from technology and social solutions that arise from technology comes out of science fiction. We talk about Brave New World, we talk about Soma, we talk about Morlocks, we talk about Eloy, we talk about Frankenstein complexes, we talk about 1984 and Good Speak and Bad Speak and Doublethink, and we talk about we talk about the three laws of robotics, and when we think about space, our whole dialogue about space is guided by science fiction. The average human being's direct first-person conscious experience of space is very limited. Although we use GPS all the time, most of us don't actually think much about what actually happens in space. We might look up at the sky every now and again and see that a bunch of stars move faster and go, they're probably too slow to be airplanes, so they must be satellites. But everything we think about space comes out of science fiction, more or less.
And by changing language, you change reality.
Yeah, well, by changing narratives, you change reality. I mean, decision-making, for example, we tend to think of decision-making as being driven by cusps, like you get to a fork in the road and you either go left and you go right, you either, you know, get married or you carry on being single. But really, our decision-making is best understood as a narrative that we tell ourselves, where we get to a point and we tell ourselves the college story, we tell ourselves the marriage story, and we think about how a particular course of action fits in with a narrative. And so when we talk about space or robotics or any of those other things, or network communications or social unrest, those arise out of narratives. And so really, it's only by shifting narratives that we shift politics and social attitudes altogether.
Revolutionary books.
You mean, what does it mean to be revolutionary as a book? Book that comes to my mind, or books, are the books by W.G. Sebald. It's pure poetry, you know. Just beautiful. He's a wordsmith. It's just exquisite, but nothing pompous. There's nothing abrasive about it, and yet he takes you into deep areas of yourself, and that way perhaps it's revolutionary.
Revolutionary books. There's been some challenges of history. I read a lot of history, so some challenges to establish views of history. Anthony Beaver in history has written an awful lot of things which have challenged it. I came to see the other night a chap who was talking about his book on an accident in Everest in 1996, and he thought he had some new revolutionary ideas as to what had really gone wrong in it. And I really was very sceptical about the whole thing, to be honest. I mean, 15 years later, as he put it in his own words, $300 million has been made by people writing about this thing. So what's he think he's going to add to the equation right now? And I thought, I was very sceptical about that. But that's one aspect of a revolutionary book, because he's saying what the other guy said who made $300 million was wrong.
Germs on Steel by Jared Diamond. What it shows me, at least, is that sometimes, despite your best intent, sometimes the choice is already made. But what it also shows us that possibly there's a way to overcome it.
Well, so far in this programme, we've been talking about social revolution, but obviously technological revolution is very much part of the picture. And with me here now are Siddhartha Deb and Angela Saini, who both examine what technology is doing to India. And I'd like to start, Angela, by asking you, why did you call your book Geek Nation?
Well, there are Indian geeks all over the world. They've become a social stereotype. In Hollywood, for example, there are very few Indian characters, but the ones that there are tend to be doctors or scientists. So I wanted to explore this as someone of Indian geeky ancestry myself. I wanted to see how far that was true. And certainly India is very much enthralled to science and technology at the moment. This is not always a good thing. Sometimes it can adopt technologies, or in the case of corruption and bureaucracy, it can adopt technologies thinking that it will fix problems, all problems, when it won't. On the other hand, sometimes investment in science, history has shown us, can be a great thing. It can lift a nation out of poverty, it can industrialise a nation slowly. So on both sides, journalistically, it was a fascinating project for me.
What proportion of the population have access to any sort of computer or cell phone? It's mainly cell phone.
There are something like 500 million cell phone connections.
Half a billion,
yes.
That is quite mind-blowing.
Yeah, it really is. And that means that it's quite an egalitarian technology in that way. Most people have access to it. I did a piece once on electronic waste, so where our waste goes after we're finished with our gadgets. And someone at Nokia India told me that a handset, a mobile handset, actually gets passed through quite a number of users because it is the kind of technology that, you know, you can top up rupees at a time to make phone calls, and so a cheap handset will be used for years, whereas I, for example, might throw it away after a couple.
You mentioned the local payment stations where people can go and cut out bureaucracy at a local level and pay all their bills.
Yeah, it's called electronic governance, and there has been a big move for a long time on the part of the government to harness science and technology to try and solve the problems of governance and bureaucracy. So the hope is that by providing these kiosks all over India, even in very rural villages and in far, far out of the way states, where ordinary people can be trained up to run these kiosks. It's very basic technology. And then people can go there to pay all their bills, access their death records, land records, which actually may not sound like a huge thing, but is a massive change in terms of how you could access those government data before. It's still in the process of happening, but many of those kiosks have already been set up all over India.
I get a feeling that actually this new technology is strengthening the status quo. It's not undermining it as it has in the Arab countries, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, we've seen the social media. I mean, it's in fact led to a great sense of complacency. I mean, if I talk about, for instance, you know, if there's a lawsuit against a chapter of my book, which doesn't appear, a lot of people pass it around the internet. And they mean well, but I've been telling people that, you know, it's actually still illegal to publish it in India, and the fact that you can put it on the web means you have the virtual space, but they have the actual public space. And democracy is a combination of both. It's not about just having, you've got to go out to Tahrir Square, and you've got to go there as a mass movement. We don't have a mass movement yet because we are not together. We are still very divided. And technology has the capacity. It's a very neutral thing. It can bring people together or it can divide them. It can be used to be done policing. It's in Kashmir. Facebook profiles have been very convenient for the Indian Army to crack down on people trying to do a Tahrir Square. So it's a neutral thing. And technology, I think at the moment, has become a kind of way to avoid these larger questions that we need to ask about equality and democracy, which aren't being asked.
This is the first chapter of your book, which has been banned in...
That's right.
The one, and it's because it's satirical, shall we say, about a certain speaker at a conference you went to.
Well, I mean, you may call it satirical. Other people have said it's poorly researched, and I disagree, but I certainly wouldn't slap a lawsuit against them. I think people are completely... I mean, this is by a man who runs a media empire of his own, who pontificates on television, on the web, about how Google should be shut down, and in fact actually speaking against technology while using technology. This is fascinating. He's a man who's against Facebook, against Twitter, against Wikipedia, against Google, even though he's using YouTube and he's using technology. So, you know, there are all these contradictions.
So basically, he has used his cultural status mm-hmm. to act against freedom of speech.
Yeah, but he's used, in some sense, the old laws.
Yes, fascinating.
Yes, but he's also very much a man of the modern man. He's a man built by the internet, who is against the internet, and actually the Indian government has passed a series of internet laws. India is actually a very difficult country to get a cell phone in if you don't have an Indian passport. In India is a country where if you go into a shop, if you want to go into a cyber cafe to use the internet to check your email, you have to give them copies of your passport. They have to make photocopies of your passport. It's a place where it's actually quite hard because there's a lot of governmental scrutiny and oversight, big brother kind of oversight over this supposedly free country. It's actually not a very free place.
Mm-hmm. Now, just one final question. Do you consider yourself geeks? And if so, how does this represent itself?
I self-define as a geek. I didn't always, because it wasn't always a good thing. People used to say that we were the antisocial ones that nobody wanted to be friends with. But geekiness is cool now, and we look up to icons like Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg and say, we want to be like them. They're the coolest geeks in the world and very rich.
Siddhartha.
I'm a failed geek. I aspire to
You wear geeky glasses? Both of you do.
Oh, we do. That's true.
I call that geek chic.
All right, geek chic. Okay. We'll take it.
Why are you a failed geek?
So I was supposed to have gone to an engineering college, and I didn't. I turned my back on it at the very last minute. I said, I can't go to the REC. I would rather study literature. And they said, you will be a failure. You will beg on the streets. Which is fair enough.
that's it for today's programme. It was presented by Sarah Crown
and Claire Armistead.
It was produced by Francesca Panetta.
Till Thursday, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.